Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Medication Madness, and now Psychiatric Drug Withdrawal, it's the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour with guests unafraid to speak the truth about psychiatry and psychology and about how you can make the most of your own life.
And this is Peter Bregan. Hello to my marvelous audience. I have a really interesting guest today. No surprise, I hope. We have marvelous guests from around the world. And our guest this week is from Great Britain, and not the first of the folks we've had recently from Great Britain. And I'm really getting a sense of what a different world it is over there. But before I introduce him, I want to remind you about something, or tell you about something for the first time, depending on who you are. There are really two good films out now about the drug industry and about psychiatric drugs and about their dangers. One of them has been around for a few years now, Generation RX, by my dear friend, Kevin Miller, the filmmaker. And another newer film, American Addict. You can locate both of these, Generation RX and American Addict, on the internet. Google it. These are films that you should watch for your own interest and edification. They're films that you can build a conference around of professionals or of people recovering in the recovery movement. You can use these films to teach your classes. They have a lot of different uses. If you're a new professional, you could probably show this film somewhere for free and meet new people and establish your identity in a community. They're really very good tools of communication. Generation RX, and now this year, American Addict. Very, very good films. Well, my guest today is Dr. Peter Kinderman. Peter, are you there? You're clear from Great Britain?
Yes, hi.
Okay.
Hi, I am.
Let me tell you a little about this man. I don't believe there's an equivalent for Professor Kinderman in the United States. Perhaps he could tell me there is. But I don't think there is, especially since Bertram Caron at Michigan State is retired. He is a professor of clinical psychology. He's an honorary consultant in clinical psychology with the Mercy Care, the National Health Service. Most interesting to me, he's head of the Institute of Psychology, Health and Society at the University of Liverpool. Now, this is a major academic position. He has over 200 academic staff, 31 of them are professors, again, at the University of Liverpool. They include clinical psychologists, psychiatrists, general practitioners, sociologists, nurses, people interested in psychology, health, and society. Among the staff, names that some of you will be familiar with, John Reed, Richard Bentel, because they've done very good work in being critical of ECT, electroconvulsive therapy. And you can find their papers on my website that I developed just to provide information on the ECT, which is called ectresources.org, ectresources.org. I hope people are using it more and more. I put hundreds of hours into that website. There's no charge for it. It's just was needed to have a resource on shock treatment, so I just put a lot of time and energy into that. So I'm really delighted. Peter Kinderman, welcome to the show.
It's a pleasure. Thank you very much.
What do you think about my observation, just springing it on you here? I don't think there's anyone quite like you in the United States who has so much academic seniority, who has on his staff people like John Reed, Richard Bennell. What do you think? Is there a difference between the U.S. and Great Britain?
I think, I think less that there's a difference between the U.S. and Great Britain, and I think more that some of the views that were considered to be very extraordinary and radical and almost unacceptable in polite society have now become mainstream. I don't think there's anything extraordinary about me or my role at Liverpool. I don't think it's extraordinary at all that somebody can be running a university department which has some clear-sighted psychologists and psychiatrists who are promoting psychosocial perspectives on mental health and opposing some of the worst excesses of the biomedical reductionist regime that we see. That's not extraordinary, because I think that we're starting to win the argument. These ideas are becoming more and more mainstream, and so all it reflects, I think, is that it's no longer unusual or strange for conventional academics to be propounding these sorts of views. The evidence is backing them up, and therefore my role at Liverpool is seen as an entirely conventional head of department role, and people like John Reed and Richard Bentall are seen as entirely appropriate ambassadors for their discipline. It might be the case, and I hate to say this to an American audience, it might be the case that America has a little way to go before it accepts that these points of view are mainstream, but you'll get there.
One of the difference, perhaps, is the much greater influence, am I right, in the farms that the pharmaceutical industry has over our academia in terms of the amounts of money it spends.
I think so, not only in terms of sheer buying power by the pharmaceutical industry in America. The amount of money is extraordinary. America is, it's a very wealthy nation. But also therefore the proportion of, the sheer amount of money available to people whose research supports a pharmaceutical perspective. I think it's also something slightly different, which is culture, which is in the UK, the idea of being independent and not beholden to one's commercial backers is seen as very, very important. It's a very important tradition in academia. So, for instance, when we read some of the accounts of the very close links between the pharmaceutical industry and academic psychiatry and psychology in the US, I think, to be perfectly honest, most psychologists and psychiatrists in the UK would be embarrassed if those sorts of links were revealed, because we would strive to be seen as independent and impartial and not bought out by commercial interests.
And it's so different from the U.S. I mean, we've got this business with Joseph Biederman literally creating the diagnosis of childhood bipolar in order to feed Johnson & Johnson and other drug companies on the lives of children, getting more and more antipsychotics to them. I mean, and he hasn't even left Harvard. He's still there.
Yeah. I mean, you may not necessarily like what I'm going to say next, but, your show is famous for having freedom of speech, I guess. I actually honestly believe that in large part that's due to the way that we have provided healthcare, mental health care, for people in the UK. So the vast majority of people providing mental health care in the UK are salaried by the National Health Service. And although I receive my salary from the University of Liverpool and work for the local National Health Service Trust on a pro bono basis, essentially it's a part of a partnership between the academic universities in the UK and the health service in the UK. And I guess what that means is that as an individual, and when I look at my colleagues, including in psychiatry, we're not really dependent on funding streams, on commercial sources. We're not even dependent on our clients paying our salaries. We are dependent on the state paying our salary. But that then allows us a great deal of freedom to pursue what our conscience and what our professional obligations tell us is right. And we're pretty confident that we will be supported as long as we operate within the parameters of our profession. And I think that makes a huge difference. It's an unpleasant thing to say to North American colleagues, but I think that the commercial approaches taken both within academia and within the delivery of healthcare in the U.S. are not perfect to my eyes.
Well, that is interesting, and you probably guess I'm not thoroughly in agreement with you, but I'm not even going to go there because I just think what you're saying and your opinion is so important. Now, in this country, maybe there's also a difference in the government, because in our country, certainly the government is among the first to suppress any dissent within the field of psychiatry. The National Institute of Mental
Health...
You know, they when the NIMH holds a conference, they weed out any serious criticism before they let anybody speak. So maybe there's also a difference in the way the government participates here in our intellectual lives.
Well, I mean, what I don't want to do, because I don't know, I simply don't know, is how the U.S. government is involved in either academic or clinical activity in the U.S. I don't know. What I do know is in the U.K., I don't know anybody who's felt that to any great extent. The government, well, the government itself will never intervene. And in terms of being advised that the course of action that you're taking is unwise, it's almost always in the U.K. your own professional colleagues who will take you to one side and advise you to take a different course of action. But the idea that we would be constrained by the state is rather weird. I mean, this is a conversation that's veering slightly into politics, which I hadn't expected. But one of the things when I go to the states, and I go to the states quite frequently, is that despite being the land of the free, the involvement of government seems to be quite high. In the UK, where we have state-controlled healthcare, socialized healthcare, universal healthcare provided through taxation, and essentially one monopoly supplier, paradoxically, we don't really seem to feel the state impacting on our decisions at all. As a clinician working in the National Health Service, I'm empowered by my politicians to do whatever I think is right for my individual client, and that's what I do. So I think that the political situation in the U.S. and the involvement of big pharmaceutical companies, and then the engagement with both academic and clinical providers, it is very different. What I can say in the U.K., just to return to your question about me and my perhaps unusual situation, is I feel very privileged to live and work in a country that allows me enormous freedom of speech, and I think that that's important. In terms of critical psychologists promoting alternatives to the biomedical status quo in the UK, well, a senior psychiatrist told one of my colleagues only a few days ago that it was his opinion that psychological perspectives were now becoming the establishment in the UK, that to criticize psychological perspectives was now seen as unusual, and that biomedical explanations were seen as having to defend themselves against robust criticism. So I think things are changing very rapidly in the UK, and what was once odd and eccentric is now much more mainstream and more widely accepted.
Well, all this is extremely interesting. I'm very happy with how this conversation is going, the direction that it just happens to be going in. In the U.S., Dr. Kinderman, we have a situation in which the National Institute of Mental Health, the National Institutes of Health, they control the flow of research money to academia, along with the pharmaceutical industry, which also gives directly to academia. And all of that funding is biomedical, and is very little good research gets funded in the area of, say, psychosocial alternatives or family therapy or anything, even fairly conventional things that have been around for decades, yes. like family therapy. And in addition, for example, when the federal government held a conference on health services, mental health services, Bob Whitaker, who's written that marvelous book, Anatomy of an Epidemic, Bob was supposed to speak, and they wouldn't let him. And then when, and of course I wasn't invited at all, and then when there was a lot of protest about Bob being excluded, they finally let him speak, but then they had some opposition speak too. So our government is very manipulative of what's funded, what's supported, and what's literally rejected in the scientific community here. And it's very interesting that you don't experience that over there, over in the United Kingdom.
It doesn't feel like that. I mean, I should be clear that, in my opinion, there is a strong intellectual bias towards biomedical explanations, and the vast majority of psychiatrists practicing in the UK adopt, certainly use medication quite freely. They're slightly more flexible when it comes to the idea of using diagnoses. So many psychiatrists will say that they prefer to have much more narrative formulations of their clients' problems than to use diagnoses in a very strict and rigid way. But don't get me wrong. I think that psychiatry in the UK is still heavily dominated by a medical perspective, by a reliance on drugs, by an assumption that diagnostic categories are in some sense valid. I think the difference is that it's not at all odd or peculiar or threatening to criticize that point of view, and the mainstream establishment figures welcome robust debate. So I haven't had any problem in I or my colleagues being invited to debate these ideas with colleagues. And in terms of funding, well, if you looked at the proportion of funding generally that goes on biomedical versus psychosocial approaches to mental health care, I would concede that the large majority will go on biomedical approaches. But it's also the case that the state itself, that through the National Health Service and through the major funding bodies such as the Medical Research Council, will fund a lot of research into psychosocial approaches and fund treatment trials of psychosocial therapies. And individually, the way that the funds are actually disseminated is usually delegated almost without any political control to committees of experts. So, I've recently resigned from it just due to pressure of work, but I sat on a funding committee handing out many millions of pounds of state money to research. So I think it's a pretty open system in the UK. I think it's reasonably fair. If we can't win our case through argument, then we've failed to make our case properly. I think it's reasonably fair in the UK. And, of course, I should say we've also had the a major government investment program called, which some of your listeners might have heard of, called IAPT, the Improving Access to Psychological Therapies program, where the UK government has put around $1.5 billion into providing psychosocial approaches for people with various forms of mental health problem, all heavily funded from the state. So there's been major government investment in psychological approaches.
It's very, very different than the U.S., and you're making that clearer probably than any of the guests we've had so far. You know, folks, I'm hoping, right now it looks like we're going to be having a conference in 2015 with our group here, you know, Ginger and, mm-hmm. and my group and our 75 or so advisory council members, with the Critical Psychiatry Network. And yes. Dr. Kinderman's a psychologist, not a psychiatrist, but he knows all the folks I know and, of course, many, many more in Great Britain. And I hope you'll get involved in that conference. It just sounds like there's so much more vitality in Great Britain right now around these issues than in the U.S. And I think that's very exciting. I think it's a misfortune that the U.S., we are just so still under the thumb of the pharmaceutical industry here. And I don't see that breaking down very rapidly at all here in the U.S.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think one of the ways that it might have been taken forward in the U.K., and we might want to think about this across the Atlantic, is I think there's a lot of fellow feeling between psychology and psychiatry in the UK. So a lot of my fellow plotters, let's say, the people that I discuss ideas and concepts and approaches to helping people with are in fact psychiatrists rather than psychologists. So although we have many differences of opinion, especially between people who use a biomedical approach on the one hand, or use a diagnostic approach versus people with a more psychosocial perspective. When you look at people like Joe Moncrief, whom you know very well, Sami Tamimi, Phil Thomas, Pat Bracken, these are people who are psychiatrists, but they have a more psychological approach to their work than many psychologists.
Yes, and by the way, Each of them is a member of the advisory council of our organization,
The
Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy. I'm really very glad to be getting to know you. Most of my contacts have been with psychiatrists, and particularly in recent times, now that I'm a part of the Critical Psychiatry Network over there. And it just sounds like you have such a more robust academic community in Great Britain than in the U.S. And I know you're coming to visit here, and I hope that maybe you can give hope and maybe a little courage to American psychologists to be more forthcoming. Certainly, clinical psychology in America, I think, is almost a dead profession because it has become the handmaiden of psychiatry. And has not produced very much creative work, very much in the way of even academic books of great worth in my experience in the last few decades because of that. And a lot more interesting things clearly are going on in Great Britain.
Well, one of the things. I was going to say one of the things that a colleague of mine, Brent Robbins, who is now president of one of the divisions of the American Psychological Association. We met in Hawaii, of all places. You get to travel around the world when you're an academic. And we met in Hawaii, and we were saying that one of the things that we need to encourage American clinicians to understand, I think, is that we already have alternatives to the biomedical model. So one of the things that I think possibly frightens people is it comes out of the British political system, but there's something called TINA, T-I-N-A. There is no alternative. And it's the idea that if you believe there is no alternative to the status quo, you'll just go along with it. And you'll actually be slightly threatened by the idea of people challenging it. But if you were able to realize that there are already alternatives, then that changes the situation. So as an example, a colleague of mine from Manchester, whom I know very well, Anthony Morrison, has recently had a paper published in The Lancet, the very prestigious medical journal, describing cognitive therapy for people who have psychotic experiences, who have been diagnosed as having schizophrenia, where they have refused medication or chosen not to take medication, and looking at the effectiveness of cognitive therapy for that group. And it's been proved to be very effective for them. Not perfect, but very effective. Leading one very senior psychiatrist in the UK to suggest that cognitive therapy, psychological approaches, are, in his words, probably as effective as medication, which is a strong statement. The reason why that's important is that if people were to understand that a little bit more, maybe they'll realize that there is an alternative. And once you realize there's an alternative and you start thinking differently, it opens your mind to the possibility of challenging a whole load of otherwise unchallenged ideas. You know, maybe if psychotherapy is, open quotes, as effective as medication, then, you know, just maybe you might want to think about offering it to people as a first-line treatment. Maybe because it comes from a different tradition, you'll think twice about the diagnostic approaches. It just starts to open up people's minds. So one of the things is to impress upon people that there are, in fact, already well-established alternatives. We don't have to wait for a brave new world where our colleagues invent something new for us. The alternatives are already there.
Those are such important and incisive words. I think you put it very, very, very well. And I think that's real, what you're saying. You know, it's one of the main reasons why when Ginger and I were developing a new organization, we decided to name it not in terms of being critical of psychiatry, but in terms of alternatives. So we named it the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, rather than, you know, the Center for Critical Psychiatry or something like that.
Yes, yes.
So I just think it's so important what you're saying. When we come back, well, we've still got a minute or two, but for the second half of the show, folks, I'm going to ask Dr. Kinderman to talk much. By the way, I have so much respect for your position, I'm calling you Dr. Kinderman. I think you're the only person I've ever called doctor on the show. Peter Kinderman.
Okay.
I mean, it's all first name on the show, but I just respect the fact that you hold this position and that you are moving more and more in the direction that you're describing. When we come back, he's going to talk about psychosocial alternatives, his work in that area, and we'll both talk about what's going on in the world that is increasingly demonstrating the value of psychosocial alternatives. His name is Peter Kinderman. It's spelled exactly like it sounds, K-I-N-D-E-R-M-A-N. And he's head of the Institute of Psychology, Health and Society at the University of Liverpool in Great Britain. We could go to music now. I think we're a minute early, but I think we're at a good stopping point. And we can pick up when we come back on psychosocial alternatives. And this is Peter Bregan, back again with my guest, Peter Kinderman. Before going back to Peter, do remember to, give us a plug on iTunes. Do whatever you do there to show folks that you're listening to us. We appreciate that. We want to keep building our audience, influencing people with the best folks in the field of mental health from around the world who are on this show today, being a really, really good example. Peter, one of the things I do that is indulgent on my show is that I tend to ask my guests about the influence of my own work, and I don't think mm-hmm. my work has had a particular influence on your growth and development, but it sounds like from our conversation that it's kind of becoming more acceptable in Great Britain in general, the things I've been saying about the harmful effects of drugs and how they work fundamentally by disabling the brain.
Yes. I mean, I suppose one of the things that's important for me is one of the sort of a welcome, fortunate, positive experiences that I've had is that I've now twice been chair of the British Psychological Society's Division of Clinical Psychology. So what I've proudly described as the professional body for UK clinical psychologists. And that has meant that, in part, I felt the need to remain cautious of not digging too far into two things. First of all, into outright condemnation of other professions' activities, but also avoiding straying away from my area of expertise. So I think that my approach to the use of medication is I go along very much with the practical steps that Joe Moncrief, who I know is a colleague and friend of yours, goes with. The evidence as I see it is that the harm of electroconvulsive therapy clearly outweighs its benefits. And in any case, I tend to be opposed to approaches which are predicated on the idea that there's something physically wrong with people's brains that need to be put right in some way with physical interventions. When it comes to antipsychotic medication, I'm very much swayed by the evidence of Bob Whittaker, or the evidence that Bob Whittaker has collated, and the analysis that Joe Moncrief and others have put in, showing that the long-term effects of antipsychotic medication seem to me to outweigh their benefits, that for some people, antipsychotic medication might be a helpful or positive experience in the short term. But apart from that, my attitude is I don't know enough. I'm not a medic, so I don't know enough about the biochemistry of medication to state with any confidence that I know how they are supposed to work and how they can be improved. In a sense, I possibly am a little bit cautious. Maybe I fight shy of it, but I see that the side effects outweigh the benefits. I tend more, I think, along the lines that many chemicals, alcohol, caffeine, nicotine, street drugs, recreational drugs, and then the drugs prescribed by medical doctors all affect the functioning of the brain. I don't see a great deal to distinguish between them. Whether I would go as far as to say that I'm confident that the psychiatric medication achieved its effects through damage to the brain, I'm a little bit more agnostic on that, to be honest.
Let's go and talk now about just the psychosocial approaches. Tell us, the basis of your sense that we know we already have alternatives. I'd love to hear your summary or commentary on this idea that we already have psychosocial alternatives.
Okay, so I think what it is fair to say is that the standard medical psychiatric model of today is so dominant that very few people experience alternative, fully worked through, properly planned alternative, I suppose in the jargon you might call them service delivery packs. So there aren't services that are set up from head to toe on broadly psychosocial principles. But we can look at the Soteria project and the Open Dialogue project, especially in Northern European countries, especially in Finland. So in Finland and other countries, some of the Open Dialogue and Soteria-based approaches function whereby the expectation is that when somebody is extremely distressed, that the first line of approach will be to offer them somewhere to stay, somewhere to live, obviously temporarily, but somewhere to live that's calming and reassuring. They'll be well-staffed. These things are not cheap, but they'll be well-staffed. They'll be looked after. And it won't be presumed that people will receive medication. It will be presumed that the correct thing to do is to keep people safe, keep people calm, and provide them with a venue where you as a professional, they as the person suffering, and their family can talk. So this open dialogue approach is a different expectation for how people enter services. And certainly in Finland, the open dialogue projects in Finland are very successful, with Finnish psychologists, psychiatrists, and social workers being very keen to promote an open dialogue approach for the design of services. What we see is that when you look at completely alternative ways, so when you look at, for instance, Richard Warner's work on the importance of employment on work for people with serious mental health problems, we know that when we provide people with employment, when we provide people with meaningful and purposeful activity that's genuinely rewarding to them, their experience of mental health problems drops actively. We know that psychosocial approaches, psychotherapies, and especially cognitive behavior therapy are effective for a very wide range of problems. They're recommended in Britain by the National Institute for Clinical Excellence as frontline treatments for a wide range of mental health problems. Admittedly, at the moment, usually in combination with medication, but as I say, even in the case of so-called schizophrenia, the work of Toni Morrison and others is starting to give us quite convincing evidence that psychosocial therapies can be an alternative to treatment. And I think that when we put that together, there's quite convincing evidence that a wide range of problems that admittedly need to be put together into a coherent service delivery model are effective. I think it's also worth saying that the current system simply doesn't work. So that if you read the work by Bob Whitaker, long-term antipsychotic medication seems to reduce your chances of having a fulfilling and meaningful life, reduces your life chances. Compulsory mental health treatment under Mental Health Acts and so forth seems to have very little effect on people's future functioning. And in anything other than the most immediate short term, the medication appears to be, well, at least outweighed by its negative effect and possibly slightly harmful. So I think that we also know not only that the psychosocial alternatives can be effective, but the current biomedical approaches aren't stunningly wonderful for people. I think it's also important for me as an academic psychologist to say that we understand quite a lot about why people become depressed, why people become anxious, why people develop other forms of mental health problems. So in a wide range of different types of problem, what we find is that psychosocial variables seem to contribute to the origin and the maintenance of people's problems. We know that loneliness, loss, poverty, unemployment, social isolation contribute to anxiety and depression. We know that very large numbers of people who go on to develop so-called psychotic problems have been abused in one way or another. We know that people are subjected to racism and discrimination are more likely to suffer from psychotic problems. So when we put all of that together, there seems to me to be rather insufficient evidence for a wonderful biomedical model and quite convincing evidence that psychosocial variables are causes of and maintain mental health problems and that psychosocial interventions can help.
That's a good summary. Folks, let me remind you, this is not up on the internet yet, if you would like to visit Michigan State University next year, April 17, 18, and 19, our group, myself, Ginger, and all of our many wonderful advisors, we're putting on a joint conference with Bertram Caron, who's a professor emeritus of psychology and a psychologist of the year at Michigan State. We're going to have a conference 17, 18, and 19, and at least half of it, maybe more, is going to be about really good psychosocial alternatives. Peter Kinderman has mentioned open dialogue. We're going to have representatives of the open dialogue group. presenting for a few hours to really let people know about alternatives for helping really deeply disturbed people. So we'll be there April 17, 18, and 19, Michigan State. Just put it on your calendar, and within the next month or so, we should have all the details up. Peter Kinderman, would you talk some more about something we haven't dealt with hardly enough on this show at all, which is what we know about how disturbed behavior has disturbing antecedents. How's that for a simple statement? Go ahead.
Well, the best thing to do is to quote something that my colleague John Reed said just shortly after he arrived at Liverpool. He, of course, being a professor, had a book launch for his new book, and he introduced the book to the small audience of people there to drink cheap white wine and eat pretzels, where he said, for the past 20 years, I've tried to point out that people feel bad when bad things happen to them. And that's what the evidence suggests. So, very large numbers of people, not all, not every single person, but very large numbers of people, a very high proportion of people who have so-called psychotic experiences, who hear voices or hold unusual beliefs or are very paranoid, have experienced childhood trauma. And one of the things that John Reed and Richard Bentall showed in a recent meta-analysis was that the relationship between childhood trauma and psychosis was dose-related. So if you are able to calculate, in very crude and simplistic terms, admittedly, but if you're able to calculate how many assaults of various kinds people have experienced in childhood, whether they've been brought up in poverty, whether they've been emotionally neglected, whether they've suffered physical or sexual abuse, whether they've been bullied at school. When you add up the types of experiences that people have had, what you find is a dose relationship with the probability of developing psychosis. The more trauma you experience as a child, the more likely you are to experience psychosis. We know that these things interact with other variables. In fact, I think quite a small way with biological or genetic issues. Heritability, inheriting things from your parents, doesn't seem stunningly important. But taking street drugs, especially at neurodevelopmentally important times in your childhood, possibly is important. If you're confused and distressed, if you've had some disturbing and distressing experiences in your childhood, it's probably an unwise idea to take large quantities of street drugs that stimulate dopamine and serotonin. But what we know is that trauma, abuse, experiences of racism, experiences of discrimination are all statistically related to the origins of psychosis. We also know that people who develop acute problems, who report with distress, are very likely to have experienced other negative life events in the 6 months prior to presenting with problems. And we even know that it increases your likelihood of presenting with serious mental health problems if the events that you experience are thematically related to your traumas in childhood. So people who've been exposed to sexual abuse in childhood, if they subsequently get raped, then they're at serious risk of developing mental health problems. So all in all, I mean, it looks to myself and to John Reed and colleagues very much like a pretty straightforward etiological pathway, that things that happen in your childhood make you vulnerable to future mental health problems. And that's entirely understandable. Your mental health is intimately dependent on how you make sense of the world, how you think about yourself, how you think about other people, your plans for the future. And all of those ways of thinking, that framework of understanding of the world, of course, is shaped in childhood. So for me as a psychologist, it's neither terribly surprising nor particularly difficult to explain how events, experiences, psychosocial factors can lead to mental health problems later in life.
Well, I'm really glad to get that summary. And folks, pay attention to what you just heard. It's not genetics. It's not biochemistry. The correlations we have with being a disturbed adult, including getting labeled psychotic, have the most to do with your childhood experiences of stress and trauma, abandonment, foster care, poverty, racism, all the things that disrupt normal growth and development contribute to your having a breakdown later in life. And Peter Kinderman made a very important point that if your later abuse that you experience, particularly, as he said, thematically relates to what happened in childhood, then you have an even greater chance of ending up, what I would say, being overwhelmed by your painful emotions when later in life.
It's also worth mentioning the brain, mentioning biochemistry, because our brain is a biochemical organ, and the way that we think about the world is dependent on, is controlled by chemistry. I think what's vitally important is that people understand that biochemistry is involved in our mental health, but that's not the same as these things being biochemically determined or genetic in origin. So, for instance, if I do something, if something happens to me which is rewarding, which is positive, which enhances my self-esteem, then that's going to invoke pathways in the brain that depend on the neurotransmitter serotonin and probably on the neurotransmitter dopamine. But that's true for everybody. That's not something to do with processing information about the self in people who are psychotic. That's processing information about the self. So when people who are described as hypomanic or people who are described as depressed, if we show that there are understandable, even related issues to do with the biochemistry of reward, of reinforcement, of motivation, of self-esteem, that strikes me as profound. I mean, it's important, but it doesn't mean that those biochemical abnormalities drive the disorder. You know, if something rewarding happens to me, then my reward mechanisms in my brain are going to be involved. If I feel frightened, then fear mechanisms in my brain are going to be involved. So if I were paranoid, all of the biochemical systems to do with fear are going to be involved. But then the same is true if somebody pulls a gun on me, or if I suddenly meet George W. Bush, I'm going to be overwhelmed with a flood of biochemistry. But it's not that my genes are driving that behavior, it's that the events are driving that behavior. And the best example of this is in children who grow up in abusive circumstances. What we know is that those abuse environments are related to what's called potentiation of the hypothalamic pituitary axis. So a mechanism in the brain to do with threat and stress and release of the hormone cortisol is associated with experience of abuse. But these are not children who've got abnormalities in the HPA axis. These are not children who have got abnormal pituitaries or hypothalamuses. These are kids who've been exposed to stress in childhood, and therefore their brains are responding in the way that the brain is intended, is designed, is has evolved to respond. So just because there's biochemistry involved doesn't mean to say that the biochemistry is the agent responsible for the phenomenon.
I think that's well put. I would give the metaphor that that there's no difference in the biochemistry of somebody who has become manic in an attempt to escape horrendous depression, which is how you often, in those few cases of mania we see that aren't drug-induced, that are spontaneous, they're relatively rare. That person who is euphoric and out of control is not experiencing any different biochemistry than the person whose football team has just come back and won the game in the last 10 seconds, and who now feels that life is glorious, that their cheering made the difference, that the shirt they wore made the difference, and that life is going to be great for at least the next week because their team won.
Absolutely.
It's not an abnormality. I would go one step a bit further and say that the main reason that we focus even on chemicals like serotonin and dopamine are that those are the chemicals the drug companies have focused on, because it's very clear that their drugs are causing dysfunction in those areas, and they're claiming that's great, it's an improvement. And so they do a lot of, they pay for a lot of research in those areas. I prefer to think in terms of the whole brain. It takes the whole brain to produce a happy person, a disturbed person, a religious person, an irreligious person, a good person, a bad person. It's really a whole brain activity, folks, that remains way beyond our understanding in complexity. Does that make sense to you, Peter Kinder?
It makes perfect sense to me. I mean, I think that there's another, I wouldn't disagree with any of that. I think there's another facet to this, which is that you're right. I think that drugs like neurotransmitters such as serotonin and dopamine.
I mean, really, we've got like 200 neurotransmitters we've barely looked at yet.
We absolutely have, but I think it's also interesting that serotonin and dopamine are indeed the neurotransmitters that drugs companies are interested in. They're also the neurotransmitters, incidentally, that the people who sell recreational and street drugs are interested in. So drugs such as cocaine, amphetamines, and even cannabinoids stimulate serotonin and dopamine, ecstasy, MDMA, and so forth, stimulate dopamine and serotonin release, because they're drugs of response and motivation and reward. So I think there are understandable reasons why both the licensed and unlicensed pharmaceutical suppliers are interested in those neurotransmitters.
Yeah, but we also need to keep in mind that serotonin, though, is not, it can't be reduced to some sort of reward function, nor can dopamine. Serotonin is the most widespread, not the largest, the most widespread neurotransmitter in the entire brain. Goes down the spinal cord, the serotonin in the gut, the serotonin in the bloodstream. And dopamine is the major trunk to the frontal lobes of the brain. It's what we cut when we do lobotomies. So, again, I want to just open up our thinking to realize that it's a whole new. You, every one of my listeners, you have whole brain activity, and I'm always reluctant to too much parsing it down to the neurotransmitters. Mm-hmm. We're getting quite near the end. We've got about, I would guess, 2 minutes left. I haven't gotten a warning about it. I haven't asked for one. Would you like to Peter Kinderman, would you like to make some sort of just a final statement of about 40 seconds? What would you like to tell everybody in America?
Okay, well, two things, I think. One other thing that we haven't mentioned that possibly we could is to talk about diagnosis, where I would say, as with some of the interventions that help people, I don't think we have to accept the standard psychiatric status quo when it comes to diagnosis. I think there are equally alternatives to diagnosis that we should pursue. So some of my work has been involved in criticizing the American Psychiatric Association's DSM-5 and some of the, in my opinion, nonsenses associated with DSM-5. So the first point is about alternatives to diagnosis. And I think the second point is to emphasize that, certainly for me as a psychologist, I think the psychosocial approaches are optimistic. People aren't destined to be ill because they're diseased. People have responded quite understandably and naturally to intolerable circumstances and situations. And with help, people can find ways of not only coping with those situations, but learning to deal with them effectively and move on from them with strength. When you understand that mental health is a psychosocial issue, you have a much more optimistic view of things, I think.
We're coming to an end. Peter Kinderman, a very good show, a ton of good information. Thank you very, very much.
My pleasure.